weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 418 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week is the return of Frank Gogol from Grief and Dead End Kids. He's got a new book coming out called No Heroine, and we talk about that book. Frank is one of those great creators who are also fun to talk with. So we catch up on Grief and Dead End Kids, as well as explore this new book, including the new characters. He talks about his upcoming schedule for this year and what we can expect from him in the near future. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome back to the podcast Frank Gogol, one of the writers that has really caught my attention these days. And I think someday, I just had this feeling I'm going to be writing X-Men someday, Frank. I just feel it.
God, that would be terrifying.
So you have written Grief and Dead End Kids, which we talked about before, and now you got a new book coming called No Heroine, which, of course, I'm just dying to talk about. There's some really interesting things. You sent me some information, and boy, there's just so many things I want to talk about, and that's just great stuff. But let's talk about first, when we talked the last time, you were about to have a sale for Dead End Kids and for Grief. How did that go?
Around the holidays, I always like to try and do things for people. Like when I was growing up, Christmases were pretty scant and they weren't always like a positive time for me. And like, just as I've grown up, you know, sort of, I've realized that that's a general thing outside of like Christmas and Christian, you know, households and stuff like that. So I always try to do little things around the holidays. Like every year I do a different sort of holiday short story for the newsletter subscribers that I have, send that out, and then I share it on Facebook. And like just little things, try to like pump a little hope into the world. And towards the end of last year, I was taking stock of all the stuff I had left after con season, and I had built up like a little backlog of copies of Grief, which had gone out of print in July of last year, and some odds and ends copies of Dead End Kids, first prints, second prints, variant covers. So I just threw together a real quick, I think it was like a week or 10 day long sale, so people could, you know, buy it as gifts or pick up copies they missed in stores at like a little bit of a discount, free shipping, stuff like that. You know, something to sort of give back, bring in a little end of the year income, stuff like that. And it was a really big success, honestly. Like I was supposed to have most of the packages out before Christmas, and there were so many orders that I just, between me and my wife, we couldn't fulfill it all in time. And so thank you to everyone who was patient and waited for their packages a couple extra weeks. But it was something like 150 orders, and it was a win all around for everyone. And it was pretty exciting to see like that kind of big reaction, just such like a small thing that I didn't promote very much or anything like that.
Well, did you get any feedback from the people who got the books?
Lots of people said thanks and tagged me in Twitter and Instagram posts showing that they had received the books. Surprisingly, I didn't like do any sort of hard count or anything, but I think like there were a lot more posts of people like excited to check out Grief than Dead End Kids, which, you know, given how well Dead End Kids did last year, like it was a little surprising. You know, Grief's been out for, it'll be 2 years in April. It came out in print and it went out of print, you know, almost like half a year ago now. That Ringo Award nomination towards the end of last year, I think, gave a little boost in exposure, and people were pretty excited to check it out. So yeah, it was, like I said, it was just a good experience all around. People seemed really happy, and I was happy to have a little more space in my closet.
Well, I have to say, I enjoyed both of them. You know, I had bought Grief a while back, but I hadn't gotten to read it until I was started to read Dead End Kids, and you had mentioned it was Grief, and I said, wait a minute, I have that book. And I pulled it out, and I read it, and I really enjoyed both of them. There's some things in your writing that always, you know, appeal to me. The titles, for example, we talked about that there's more than one meaning usually to a title in something you're doing, and that's true in the new book, too.
That is true.
I love that stuff. I love somebody that makes me think. You know, it's when I can think about stuff for a little while. I used to watch this show, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and I had this habit. When the show would go off, I would be 15 minutes thinking about the show. There was another show would come on after. Whatever was on was after. I didn't notice the TV was on. I was just so busy thinking about that show and what happened and what could happen. 15 minutes later, all of a sudden, I'd wake up and I'd go, oh my gosh, I got this other show on. I better turn it off.
And yeah, that is great like that. My wife's a big Star Trek nerd, and I was never into Star Trek very much. I don't like space very much. Like, Star Wars is pretty good. I think Star Trek is pretty good, but neither really is my thing. But the few episodes of Star Trek she's shown me have, like, you know, they've been really excellent, especially the Deep Space Nine stuff. Like, it's just sort of it's a different format, and it's a little more thought-provoking than the sort of adventure of the week kind of, you know, Trek and Next Generation format.
Yeah, I love Deep Space Nine because it was an extended story. It wasn't just, you know, if you didn't watch all of them, you didn't get everything involved. You know, and so I love that. I just, you know, now I talk to people. Of course, we used to, back in those days, I would watch it week after week. And now people can binge watch it. They get the whole thing done in like a week or something like that. And I'm like, wow, that's a different experience.
That's super fast. Like, what is it? It's 5 or 6 seasons, right?
Yeah, I mean, but some people have nothing to do for a week, so they sit down in front of the TV and let her rip.
That's crazy. Me and my wife just finished. I rewatched and she watched for the first time Smallville, and it was 10 seasons, and it took us about 2 years.
Like, oh, really?
Can't imagine that much entertainment in a week or even, you know, 2 weeks.
Well, the reason why I talk about that, I talked to a young guy who was that way. He was in between semesters or something, and he had nothing to do, and so he sat there and watched Deep Space Nine, and he became a huge fan watching it like that. So anyway, that's kind of the thing that your writing reminds me of, that because it's thoughtful, it's thought-provoking, it's interesting. The characters are vibrant and living. You know, when the show goes off like that, I always feel like I've lost about 30 friends. You know, and when your books are that way too, when I get to the end of them, I feel like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to these people?
It's very nice of you to say. I've actually been thinking lately sort of about like what my storytelling philosophy is. Like, I reassess this every once a year or so, just to sort of make sure that I'm staying on brand and telling the kind of stories that I want to tell. And I've sort of recently got in my head that like the philosophy is pain in poetry, like finding like that story about characters who are going through something very real and finding the like poetic, and not like the pretty flowery sense of poetry, but like the really craft focused, interestingly told version of that story. Like, those are the things I strive for. I'm not by any means saying that I do those things, but it's what I hope for.
Well, like I said, it's thoughtful. I mean, I read Dead End Kids, and by the time I got to the end of it, I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea what you were going to say, what you're going to write in there. Because, you know, sometimes I read these stories about teenagers and, gosh, they're awfully predictable. But yours was not. I really got to the end, and I was just like, I did not expect to be here when we got to the end. So, super good. So I really like that. So one thing I did want to mention on, and you sent me some information, the first issue alone of Dead End Kids, I didn't know this, sold more than 7,000 copies over 2 printings.
Yeah, that's almost true. It was 6,000 copies across 2 printings, and then there was just an insane amount of variants. A lot of stores wanted exclusive covers, and we did some for conventions, and I think that added like another 1,200 or 1,300 total copies to the number one total printings. But yeah, like that was super wild. Like, I expected the book to do like maybe 1,500, like, if that. Like, I had super modest expectations going into it, and I still do. Like, when No Heroin comes out in June, like, you know, I want to hit a certain number, but if we, you know, hit like a minimum threshold, I'll be very pleased and like just grateful that people want to check out my shit, you know.
Well, I have to tell you, I think you ought to adjust it up is what I think you should do, because I based on every time somebody comes across your stuff, and I've talked to some people online who have started reading your stuff, they always go like, my gosh, I got to read what this guy does. I've got to read it. And that's the way I am now. I want to make sure I read this stuff. And you thankfully gave me a preliminary copy of No Heroin to read. And I have to say, it was just like your other writing. I don't know what you're going to do. And somebody who's read comics for a long time, that I treasure so much. I can often predict what's going to happen. And to actually read a story that I don't know what's going to happen when I turn the page, I enjoy that tremendously. I really do.
I can't necessarily put a finger on what that is. Like, it's definitely something I strive for, to have the story not be, you know, cliche or sort of like well-trodden material. One thing I try to do, if I could like try to put a name on this, is I do this thing that I've sort of labeled for no reason other than it's obvious. I call it like the third way. They're usually things in like life and comics are presented in binary. It's this way or that way. You know, you're Democratic or Republican, you're tall or short, you're old or young. Like, I mean, like, it goes on and on and on. And like, a storytelling sort of device that I try to use is I try to set up the binary choice and then present a third option that's unexpected. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I've been sort of noodling around with, like, firming up as a specific storytelling device is this idea that there's like a scene after what you expect the end to be, like, of everything. Like, so there's this unexpected sort of epilogue or chapter extension, sort of like, you know, like what happens next is always a question that I want to explore. And I think that, yeah, action movies are especially like notorious for this, but like, think of like the end. You've seen Rambo, the first one. Mm-hmm. So spoilers for Rambo, but at the end, like, you have the climactic battle scene, and the there's almost no sort of decompression at the end. There's no sort of debrief denouement moment. Like, it just ends like on a still shot of Rambo walking away. And like, I want to sort of see like the new status quo at the end of that. And like, a lot of like dramas tend to explore that kind of stuff a little more. And I do draw a lot on the drama format. Like, Dead End Kids is a crime book. It's a coming of age book, but at its core, it's a drama. Mm-hmm. So that might be it. Like, these are questions I ask myself every day, and I sort of wonder and philosophize about with myself.
Mm-hmm. Now, I need to encourage people, if you haven't read Grief or Dead End Kids, you need to get out and get it if you can find it. Now, Grief, I guess you said, is out of print. So if somebody were to write to you, do you still have some that you might be able to share with somebody, or what's going to happen with that?
Well, it turns out that I'm extremely lazy, and I've still not taken down the listings from the holiday sale on my website. Okay. It's on my to-do list. It just keeps getting bumped down by more pressing things. So people can still order the book directly from me. The one small caveat would be that there's a little bit of a shipping charge. Yeah, to cover the cost of like the box and taking it to the post office and whatnot, and a little bit for my wife's labor, because she's the one who tends to pack those up for me. It's if people want to check it out, there, I think I've got a handful of copies left, like maybe around 20. And they're going to come with me to conventions for the first part of the year till they run out. So anyone who's listening who wants to check the book out, it's frankogle.com/store. And then there's a whole bunch of listings. Just pick the one that has Grief on it. This is by no means me saying anyone should go out and buy the book, but if you feel so moved to, they're absolutely there for the people who are interested.
Now, of course, I got a couple questions I got to ask. Are you done with those series? Is there not going to be any follow-up to Grief or Dead End Kids?
Grief, in my mind, is a one-off. Like, I just, it's a kind of like lightning in a bottle that I know I couldn't capture again. And it's one of those things where, like, I'm very grateful that it was my first book. It was tremendously good to me. When it was a Kickstarter, it was super successful. It was my first book to ever be picked up for print publishing. It sold thousands of copies via print publishing, sold out, which most indie books don't ever do. And then netted me my first major award nomination. Like, I mean, as far as first books go, like, that's a hell of a track record. And I don't know that I could honestly get myself excited about trying to one-up it or match it or do something similar. I will say that there is a second print coming down the line. I spoke with the publisher a while back and after it sold out, and we discussed the possibility of doing a second printing. It'll be a little bit of a different version, not too different, but it'll have a different cover. It'll have a little bit of a different inside, but it'll essentially be the core same book. And I wanted to do that for two reasons. One, I like to experiment. I work at a startup in marketing, and like every day I'm at work, it's always experimenting and collecting data and trying things. And that's something I try to bring to my comics. So we're going to try like a slightly tweaked version of it to see if it'll sell differently or better with certain audiences. It sells very well with women in the format it is now, and almost as well with men. So we're going to try a cover that we think maybe might speak better to a male audience. So it's just little things like that. Hmm. The other reason I wanted to sort of present a different version of it for the second printing is because, like I just mentioned, it's an extremely special book to me. It's been super good to me. And for me, it's sort of a testament to the people who stood by me and supported me early in my career. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that the people who bought the first print like had that version for themselves. Like it's for them and not necessarily the people who come after. Not that they're any less valuable or less important to me, but it's like I'm always looking for nice, special ways to take care of people who take care of me. You know what I mean?
Well, the first ones are always going to be the ones that are, I mean, they tend to be long-term fans, the first ones do. Other people who come in a little later, they'll stay with you most likely too, but some of them kind of move on to, they're looking for the next big thing and then move on a little bit. So I'm pretty sure that those people who supported that are going to, you know, are very happy about it. But now, Dead End Kids, is that done too, or is that, you got another story in mind for that?
The answer is yes and no, and it's not as scandalous as it sounds. We're going to do a second volume of Dead End Kids, and it may be out toward the end of this year, depending on how fast we can get it together and what the publishing schedule looks like. But the publisher did ask me to do more, and what we're going to do is we're going to take a True Detective type approach to it, where it's basically it's the same concept, like, you know, adolescent crime book. Mm-hmm. With like that really heart-wrenching sensibility to it. But we're going to cast it with different kids in a different place and a different time period. So I just finished the long form outline for the plot. So I haven't scripted anything yet, but I'm generally a pretty fast scripter. So depending on the feedback I get for that long form breakdown, whatever tweaks I need to do, I have to consult with a couple people on some things, because there's some stuff that I'm not an expert on that I want some guidance on so it's authentic. But I imagine I'll have the script done for that sometime in March, and maybe like the finalized script sometime in April. So depending on how things go, it very well could be out this year. I'd love for it to be out this year. Like, I feel like it's still on people's, you know, the tip of their tongue, and they're still thinking about it, and I wouldn't want it to get too far in the rear view if it did more. Mm-hmm. I can say a little bit about the sort of plot. It's not going to be called Dead End Kids 2. It's going to have a subtitle rather than a 2. It's going to be called Dead End Kids, The Suburban Job, sort of a play on The Italian Job. Mm-hmm. But it's like a child heist book. Imagine something to the tune of four kids walking to a bank, but not funny.
Okay. Because I have to say, you know, it's interesting, of course, when you have two works, somebody's always going to try to say which one is the one they like best. I enjoy Grief, but I really, really got into Dead End Kids. So that was my favorite of the two so far, but I really like that. So I'm dying to see the follow up to it, because that one just spoke to me on several levels. So,
well, if you'd like to be one of the people to give feedback on the plot, I'd be happy to share it with you.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd be happy to. I like to do that stuff. People kind of send things to me, and then I give them feedback. Many times I write reviews and stuff, so I'm used to giving feedback and stuff. So That'd be fun to see. I'd like to see how that's gonna move, because that one really, like what we talked about the last time, I don't want to spend too long on Dead End Kids, but we talked about this a lot last time, because I really got into the different things that were going on. The title had different meanings, the different characters, all the different things that went on, the surprises that took place. And I loved that book. It just spoke to me so much. Grief was a great book. Don't think it wasn't a great book, but Dead End Kids was the one that resonated with me a little more.
That's what I hope for, honestly. Like, every book I write, I don't necessarily have a person I want to write the book for in mind, but I sort of imagine each book being for different kinds of people. Like, Grief is for people who are going through things. Dead End Kids is for people of a certain age range. Not that other people can't enjoy it, but it's for, you know, somebody who had a similar early life to me growing up in the suburbs and in a not wealthy area. And, you know, also likes, you know, like murder mysteries. But as long as people like the book, I don't care which one they like. I don't care Hate Grief and Love Dead End Kids or vice versa. As long as they find some value in some of my writing, I am always grateful.
Well, it's like choosing amongst your kids. You know, you can't choose amongst your kids and survive, in my opinion. So we got to, you know, I think different people get different reactions based on where they are. And what, like when you and I talked last time, I talked about the fact that your experience growing up was very different from mine. And I found Dead End Kids to be this kind of education on some levels, but also I felt for these kids quite a lot, you know, because it was something I hadn't gone through. And so when I began to understand what they felt, I began to really relate to them and think, gosh, you know, these are just like real kids. There are real kids out there just like this going on. It's not fiction so much as it's a story about kids that could be going through this. So that's why it spoke to me so much.
Really, well, yeah, that was kind of at least my hope. Like I mentioned earlier, like I write stories, and then I didn't mention this earlier. I mentioned it last time we talked. I try to write a drama story, like a story about some people going through something, and then wrap that up in a genre. So like I always describe Dead End Kids as being, you know, the story about childhood trauma first and foremost, and there happens to be a murder mystery going on. And Dead End Kids 2 is very much going to be like that as well. Like, not to get too much into it, and I always get overly excited and say too much, but the sort of point of starting for Dead End Kids 2 is exploring sort of the ripple effect that 9/11 had on my specific generation, and like what those kids' lives look like few years down the line, and like the different ways that affects people. But that's wrapped up in a heist story in Suburban.
Interesting.
I had like a three-act structure in mind when I first wrote Dead End Kids, the first one. Like I knew like I wanted to tackle three specific kinds of story if I ever got able to. And this was always the second one I had in mind because, like, you know, 9/11 it's just such a crystal clear day in my life. And I mean, even to this day, it still like affects my life and my decisions and like the things that like the way I view things in the past and my friends and family the same way, but in different ways. And there's just so many ways it rippled out, and to be able to dig into some of that and explore it and get to tell another sort of adolescent driven crime story was, yeah, very much something I was excited to do. So it all felt right and fell into place.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, before we get into No Heroin, you mentioned upcoming conventions and stuff. People always get mad at me because I don't get to the conventions until the very end. Can you tell us what you have planned for conventions so far in 2020?
Yeah, I've got 9 on the calendar, and I'll see if I can list them off without missing any. I'll see if I can do it in order. Let's see. This coming weekend, so it'll be after this posts, unfortunately. I've got Wizard World Portland up in Portland. Okay. After that, I will be in Chicago for C2E2, whenever the date is for that. Then I'm heading up to Seattle for Emerald City Comic Con. I'll be up in Vancouver, Canada for Fan Expo Vancouver. That'll be my first time going international, even though it's just 2 hours away. After that, I've got Fan Expo Dallas. I'm going to start losing them now. I don't even know how many I named. I've got Comic Palooza in Houston. I've got MegaCon in Orlando. I've got, man, there's 9 of them.
Okay.
Awesome Con in Washington.
Yep.
And there's one more in there that I'm missing, but
we can check on your website if we want to catch up.
Yeah, or if anyone listening wants to get on my newsletter and get those free holiday stories and early access to those sales, I do a newsletter, and it's always got that information at the end. Cool. If you hop on my Instagram or my Twitter, there's a link to subscribe somewhere in there near the top.
Now, maybe we should spell your last name just so people get it right.
Yeah, all my social media handles are the same. It's just Frank Gogol, one word, FrankGogol. The Twitter and Instagram. Facebook, I think there's a period between. It's like Facebook.com/Frank.Gogol. But yeah, I'm pretty accessible online. Cool. And it's unfiltered too. Like, I don't sort of have any kind of online persona. I just say what I would normally say in real life and try to keep it real.
Now, I'm going to see you at a couple of them. I'm going to be at ECCC, I know, so far. And you're coming to my home area. You're coming to MegaCon, which is in the Orlando area, which is where I live.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I'm excited, actually. I've never been as a fan or a creator. Mm-hmm. And my brother moved there about a year ago, a little more than a year ago now, and I haven't seen him except for when he came out here for my wedding. Mm-hmm. So I haven't seen his place. I haven't, you know, gotten to explore Disneyland's out there. So to come visit.
That'd be cool. Y'all have to. I'll look for you at the con. I'm very likely going to be at a booth with Richard Rivera doing Sabbaty Bunny sales and stuff like that. It's just going to depend. But you know, those things are a little far in advance. But that's a big con. That's well named MegaCon. Yep.
Yeah, I did SuperCon last year in Miami, and I know that they're not from the same company, even though the names are fairly similar. But the Florida crowd is super good. Like, I mean, people are excited about comics down there, and you know, in a way that Californians tend not to be. I'm excited to get out, check out a different part of the state, meet some new people, and see a show I haven't done before.
Yeah, it's interesting because in Florida, there are clusters of comics creators around. There's a bunch of them in the Orlando area. There's a bunch of them in Miami. There's some up in Jacksonville. And when you go to cons and stuff, you bump into these groups and you start to get to know them. I was always surprised when I first moved down here that there were so many people interested in making comics down here, because I thought this was way far away. You know, New York, they figure Los Angeles, that's where you're going to find all these people. But there's a lot of people here in Florida.
You know, it's honestly surprising to me, and I'm very aware of this now, but especially when I first started making comics, realizing like there are very specific parts of the country where comics folks tend to congregate. Mm-hmm. like Detroit and like the sort of Detroit area of Michigan has probably the most thriving comics creator community, especially on the indie side. Definitely bigger than Portland, which always gets the attention. Right across the lake, Toronto and Canada has an incredibly thriving comics community. Florida sounds like it does. I know my buddy Jeff Ryder just moved down to the Orlando area from San Francisco. And he's meeting some people down there. So, you know, even San Francisco's got a pretty vibrant comics community. Eric Larson lives a few blocks from me. A lot of the Image owners before they moved up to Portland lived in the city. Mm-hmm. We've got some of the best comic shops in the country. I mean, Brian Hibbs, who's like the retailer in retailer circles, lives not too far from me, and his shop's in walking distance of my house. So, I mean, yeah, there are definitely pockets of creator communities and comics community in general, like really interesting places in this country.
I'll tell you one quick story, and then we'll move on to New Haven, which I want to get to. I was born and raised in northeastern Pennsylvania, and let me tell you, that is it's Lackawanna County in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Scranton, Wilkes-Barre area. I live in between.
I grew up in eastern New Jersey on the shore, but I went to high school in western New Jersey, like 20 minutes outside of Bucks County.
Oh, cool. Well, the area that I grew up in was not a comics area, and my brother and I were comics people, and we were forever getting ridiculed for that. And now what I take great comfort in, there's an actual artist who lives in my hometown and draws comics from my hometown, and I just think that is such a great thing.
Internet proliferation made the comics world so much bigger and the world itself so much smaller. I mean, you can live anywhere in the world and draw a comic or write a comic, and like, because of email and FTP and stuff like that, like, it doesn't really matter where you are.
It's great stuff, because the book that I work with, the Stabity Bunny, the three main creators have never been in the same room together. Never, ever.
I can attest to that on almost everything I've ever written. The one exception being Chris Madd, who did the covers for Dead End Kids and is drawing No Heroin. He's the, I think, my only collaborator I've ever like hung out with outside of like meeting them and passing in a con.
Wow, that's cool. The internet has made making comics something that can happen anywhere.
Really. Yeah, absolutely.
Just great. So, well, let's get into No Heron, because I want to get into that. Let's start off with the title, because right away that has multiple meanings.
Yeah, that's sort of a hallmark of my storytelling. And I don't know if I talked about this last time, but when I was in college, I took a class called like word and image, sort of like, you know, an examination of like how they work together to create meaning in like advertising and like illuminated art, like the tiger, by, William Blake, and all kinds of different things. And I wrote a paper on, it's the fifth issue of Watchmen, it's the symmetrical issue. And it's also the one that ends with, the epithet from, William Blake's The Tiger. And if it's sort of like, there's this really cool effect Alan Moore is able and Dave Gibbons are able to get by sort of referencing this illuminated poem. And an illuminated poem is just a poem that has an image that goes with it. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like a comic in a weird way. But by referencing it and referencing it at the end of the comic, you can go back and reread that issue of Watchmen after having looked at the art and read the poem and the words of the poem and get more meaning out of it. Mm-hmm. Like the poem is about this mighty tiger, you know, tiger, tiger, burning bright. But if you look at the image of the tiger that comes with the poem, it's like this really sickly, pale, like cowardly looking tiger. And it's like a total, you know, juxtaposition of imagery and meaning. And then when you go back and read the issue, like it's the first issue where you see Rorschach without a mask and you find out it's the dude with the end is nigh sign. And like the way the art is colored, like he looks, is shaped like, is colored like the tiger from the poem. And it, you know, and there's a lot of imagery and symbolism with God in the poem. And like that references back to Dr. Manhattan. There's a lot going on there. But essentially what I took from that is two things. One, that if you put your titles at the end of things, you can have like these double meanings that cast rereads into different light. So I did that all throughout Grief. Every single story in Grief, with the exception of one, has the title at the end, so you can reread it with the new meaning. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is it's that you can have layered, like a lot of people say that like the words in comics are less important than the art. And I don't disagree. I think that the art tells the story. My mission is to make sure that the words count. Mm-hmm. And that they matter at least as much as the art. And that's where that poetry I was talking about earlier comes in. Like, mm-hmm. narration is a really good one. Like, you can use narration to say things that aren't in the art and juxtapose ideas. And that's just stuff I stole from Alan Moore. Do if way gonna, less good.
No, but if you're going to steal from the best, I always say. Because it's
you know. Oh, yeah. I mean, theft is the highest form of
flattery.
That's it. And I can do worse than to steal from Alan Moore.
Yeah, yeah.
No Heroin has a double meaning. The sort of elevator pitch for the book is, imagine Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but if she was a recovering drug addict. The story is about a young woman named Kayla who is a recovering drug addict, and she sort of falls into this life of hunting monsters. You know, specifically vampires in the first one. We've talked about this. I'm not at all shy about it. I'm a huge Buffy fan. Joss Whedon's a huge influence of mine, and I've always wanted to tackle a Buffy-type story, but, you know, the way I would do it, and about, like, content that is meaningful and important to me. And so she's trying to be this better person, like, you know, being a recovered drug addict and like struggling with the that part of the process. Recovery is in a lot of ways harder than the rehabbing part or the being addicted part, because you don't have anything and you don't have the structure and it's all on you. So she's trying her damnedest to like be a better person, but she really is not a very good person. And she's learning the hard way about who she is and like the way she's going about being a good person wrong. So the sort of double entendre of the title is that she can't be on drugs anymore. You know, no more heroin, but she's also really bad at being a hero, for a lot of reasons. I mean, she's awful at it. She's doing it for the wrong reasons. basically, this is the born of my personal life in a lot of ways. Outside of my love of Buffy, the rest of the concept is in my DNA. Both of my parents had drug problems when I was growing up. My father passed away when I was about a year and a half old from an overdose, and my mom really struggled with addiction and relapse, like, throughout my childhood years. I've seen it up close and personal, and it's something that I don't love the mass media representation of sometimes. Like, we get a lot of media, especially movies and TV shows, that focus on the addiction part. Mm-hmm. And a lot of less, but still a lot of movies and television that focus on, like, the rehabbing part. You get movies like 28 Days Later, or not 28 Days, 28 Days. Mm-hmm. Sandra Bullock, not zombies. but very rarely, I honestly couldn't name one off the top of my head, do you see sort of that next part. Like, this is what I was talking about earlier. Like, here are the two expected parts. What comes next? What's the next scene? And the next scene for every drug addict who goes to rehab is recovery. Like, and what is that? What are the trials and tribulations of that? One of the things that I've seen in my own life, and like I mentioned, my parents both struggled with this, but when I was a very young teenager, like 12, 13, 14, my two best friends, my brother Joey and my cousin Tom, both really got into drugs and hard drugs very quickly and got addicted and really, to this day, have struggled with addiction, you know, being in and out of jail, being in and out of rehab, going through periods of recovery and relapse. So, like, seeing up close and personal, like, the stuff that they've specifically struggled with, especially during, like, the recovery part, like I said, like, the structure is entirely self-imposed, and that makes it the hardest because, you know, when you're an addict, there's a complete lack of structure, but you don't need structure. And when you're in rehab or jail, like, there's an imposed structure and you can just sort of go through the motions and, like, you have less agency in the matter and you have less to do with it. You just have to. But, like, once you're out and, like, you're depending on yourself, like, there's a whole list of new, like, things that you need to overcome and deal with. And one of those things is finding support. It can be very easy for asking for help to turn into taking advantage. And that's for a lot of reasons. It can be because it's easier. It can be because you don't know what else to do. I mean, I don't want to speculate about anyone's life, but this is just what I've seen. So, I wanted to sort of take an honest look at recovery and draw a little more attention to it and sort of show that next step that doesn't get talked about nearly as much and tell, like, a badass vampire story.
Mm-hmm. Now, the subtitle of the part one is her name, Kayla Strong. Does that mean that each part is going to have a different focus?
So Kayla Strong is a nickname that you find out in the story that she gave herself after she was using drugs. She would always go to her dealer and ask for like a stronger dose, something a little stronger, a little faster. And eventually she got the nickname Kayla Strong. And it ties into a tattoo that she has that says the Spanish word for strong, dura. And there's a whole bunch of stuff wrapped up in that sort of part of the narrative, especially in the first issue. Each issue will have a subtitle. I like chapter titles as, like, another layer of adding meaning to it. So, like, you know, by the end of the first issue, the idea of who Kayla Strong is and whether or not she's actually strong and where she gets her strength from is sort of explored and deconstructed and sort of shown in a new light. The second issue is titled Runaway, and the third issue is titled The Choice. And each of those titles sort of plays into the story of the issue as much as the main title does.
Interesting. Now, we got to talk about Sid, who is the friend of hers that at the beginning she's looking for.
Yeah. The mission of what kicks the book off is Sid goes missing. And it's a little bit of background. Kayla and Sid are both recovering addicts. Sid is a little bit further along and has a little more self-imposed structure, and he's doing all right. And he kind of takes Kayla under his wing while they're both living homeless in a local park. And then he goes missing one day. So she sort of sets off on this investigation to find out where he is. And then when she figures out what's happened to him, she sort of gears up for a suicide mission to save him. And that's sort of how she falls into this life of being a monster hunter.
It's really something, I have to say. She goes to a church at one point, which I thought was a really interesting development, because, you know, she's looking for strength wherever she can find it, and she understands that maybe if you go to a church and, you know, and pray and things like that, you might draw some strength on that, which I found that really fascinating, that whole business, because that wasn't what I expected to see in this book, to be honest with you.
Well, you know, there are a lot of reasons for why that scene has to happen in the book, but there's a few other reasons. The book is very punk rock in its aesthetic, and the characters, there's a brutalness to the story itself and the way it's told. But I really enjoy books that take a moment to pause and show like quieter moments. And there are two very quiet moments in the early part of the book, and then one towards the end. And like that's for, like, in talking to people who have read Dead End Kids, like, the parts they said they loved most were seeing the kids interact, mm-hmm. and seeing those smaller moments that, like, made characters feel genuine. And I just feel like that's something I like exploring more so than fight scenes or like, you know, long explanations of why the murderer was so-and-so, like a Sherlock type thing. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that there aren't action scenes. I'd say this is definitely my most action-heavy book. There's a good third of this is action scenes, but yeah, like that, the church scene is probably my favorite, and it's actually got one of the best stories from sort of the production side of things. You read the book, and I don't want to spoil mm-hmm. right away, but there's a narrative reason, sort of like mm-hmm. chess pieces moving around on the board reason for her to go to the church, and that sort of plays out toward the end. But also in the narration of that scene, it talks about how in NA, Narcotics Anonymous, there's this thing where they always make you sort of do the Lord's Prayer to open meetings or when you're feeling like, you know, you want to, you know, go out and buy drugs or something like that, that you know sort of look for strength in the Lord. And I just thought there was like a lot of really good narrative stuff to mine there. Like some of my earliest memories are of going to church basements with my mom for her meetings. Mm-hmm. And like at the time I didn't really understand what was going on, but these are still like, there's a story in Grief about this that's more, you know, autobiographical than it is fiction. Mm-hmm. But so like the idea like of drug recovery and churches is so like married in my mind that I don't know that I could tell the story without a scene like this. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I wanted to explore like this quieter moment. Kayla is Puerto Rican. She's of Puerto Rican descent. So it was an opportunity to sort of add a little authenticity there where she goes to do the Lord's Prayer and she says it in Spanish. You know, it, on the surface is just an aesthetic thing, but we dig into that a lot more as the story goes on later. And it's just, you know, it was a very important scene to me. To make sure it wasn't, and I really, really wanted to get that scene with the stained glass window hovering over her head. Mm-hmm. Taking a step back, like talking about sort of like where this book came from, Chris Madd, who is doing the art on the book, he and I shared a comic shop when I lived in New Jersey, Comic Script in Eatontown. And back then, like I didn't really realize he was as into, you know, making comics as I know, like he drew and he did graphic design, and like, you know, Chris is a good 10 or 15 years older than me, so like we didn't interact a whole lot, but like he knew that I was doing comics, and like we had, you know, talked a little bit back and forth. But then about 2 years ago, like a year and a half ago, 2 years ago this coming May, we both did Great Philadelphia Comic Con in, I think it's Phoenix, Pennsylvania, and we just got to talking. Like I was walking by and we were chatting, like we knew each other. And he was like, yeah, if you ever have like a project and you want to do something together, like let's talk. And like, I didn't ever like really think of it. I had been working on something. I can't even remember what at that point. It might've been starting Dead End Kids. And then I got on the plane on that Sunday to go home. And by the time I got off the plane, I had most of the script written for the first issue. And like, you know, it's been a really great collaboration. Chris and I have like a very shared background in that, like, you know, there's a lot of stuff with drugs in both of our histories. We both went to the same high school, grew up in the same area about, you know, like 10 or 15 years apart. We hung out in high school, you know, 15 years apart in the same park, Marine Park in Red Bank, which is the setting of the book. What I don't think it's ever mentioned, but that's what we modeled it on. Mm-hmm. It's where Comic Book Men was filmed. It's where high school was. Mm-hmm. And then like, it's just, yeah, there's just lots of good stuff. But working with Chris has been a dream. He's incredibly talented. He He's got a style unlike anything I've, you know, been fortunate to work with before. He's a true collaborator. Like, everything is a conversation. Everything is like a jam. And that scene with the stained glass is, it's crucial to the story in a way that not everyone necessarily get, but that stained glass depicts the last temptation of Christ. Mm-hmm. It's the devil tempting Jesus before he, you know, gets put on the cross. Mm-hmm. And like, that just fits so well on like a poetic level in a story about somebody who day in and day out deals with the sort of draw and attraction of giving up to temptation that like every single recovering drug addict does every single day. Wow. But awesome. Chris is a jokester. I don't know if you noticed throughout the art, there are little things in there that are hysterical. Like, there's a scene early in the book where Kayla is sort of investigating where Sid's gone to. And in the background of one of the shots is a very comic scene of a woman being dragged by her dog on a leash. There's another one where Kayla is sort of gathering weapons for a battle, and she's just walking in an alley, and there's a guy popping out of a dumpster. Like, I mean, just like stupid, funny little comedic things that sort of lighten the tone if you pay attention to the art. But when he first showed me that stained glass window of Jesus and the devil, I didn't notice this probably for about a week and damn near finalized the page with it. Rather than the traditional Jesus, he had Buddy Christ.
Oh.
Yeah. So okay. He's, you know, given the thumbs up, has like this big old grin on his face. And I don't know how I missed it. From that day forward, I paid a lot more attention to line art. But yeah, I mean, just that's the kind of working relationship we have on the book. Like, it's fun. It's very collaborative. Like, I don't think of myself as the writer. I think of us as having created a lot of the story together. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that scene is, it's one of my favorite in the book. And there's a lot more good scenes like that to come in the issues after. But I'm glad you brought that scene up, because it's worth mentioning and sort of pulling apart a little bit.
Yeah, like I said, I didn't expect it. Now, there's two more things at least I want to make sure I bring up. This is one of the reasons why drugs don't appeal to me that much, are the people around these people, around Kayla and these other people. Guy comes up in a hoodie, and he approaches her in a rather unfriendly way, let's say, and he wants to help her out, but of course there's something in return he's looking for.
Little quid pro quo.
Yeah, that's I could never, that kind of a life would be tough for me. I couldn't deal with that. So and we see several other circumstances like that through the book, and you know, maybe people who are into that kind of lifestyle get used to that kind of a thing. I would freaking run as far away as I could from it. So to me, that was a real educating, one of those educational moments that I always get out of your books, when I discover something about what it is that life is like for some of these folks. So I was really intrigued by that.
You know, it's like the church scene. That one was important for a few different reasons. I mean, later in the book, Kayla ends up taking on a whole gang of drug dealing vampires by herself. And I wanted to establish early on that like she could take care of herself in a fight. She's tough as hell. Like, I mean, she's punk rock and she's brutal and she can fight. But also, like, I don't think that in 2020, not to like get too into this because it wasn't the main point, but like, I don't know that you can write a female led book and not depict like some of the brutal side of society without, you know, doing the book justice. Like, mm-hmm. You know, like I've got a wife. I think last time we talked, I was recently married and I've been married for a while now. And I've been with my wife for about 6 years, and I've got sisters and a mom. Like, the world is not kind to women. Like, mm-hmm. You know, again, like, I'm not trying to get political. I'm not trying to get too deep into this, but that's the reality of it. Like, mm-hmm. And to pretend like it's not in a book that I am claiming is supposed to be real, like, I couldn't do it. But also, like, it was an opportunity for Kayla to flex on panel that she's a badass and can take care of herself. So it's, you know, it was probably the hardest scene to write. And I probably did, like, low ball estimate here, 10 different drafts of it. And like, it still makes me a little uncomfortable when I read it, because it's very real. Like, there's no vampire. This is like another human. Like, this could any person anywhere. But that's sort of like, that's the kind of story I want to tell. Like, this is, I want people to see the world as I see it, and you know, think about the things that I think, and you know, maybe be a little uncomfortable. Like, the subject matter I tend to write about isn't comfortable. Like, you know, losing your best friend to murder as a child is not comfortable. You know, being a child at an AA meeting or an NA meeting is not a comfortable topic. And honestly, like, I think that's, like, not to say that everybody loves my stuff, but for the people who do like grief and dead end kids and who will end up enjoying No Heroin, like, I think the thing that resonates most with them is that these are important topics that don't get talked about. And, you know, I just want to lend my voice to the conversation so it can grow a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like I said, that was something I'm not used to have happening around me. So when I am experiencing that through her eyes, I thought, wow, I thought, you know, this takes some getting used to, and you have to be somebody that's a badass that can stand up for yourself, or you could be in serious trouble.
Yeah, and you know, it's the weird thing about it is, like, you could watch Spider-Man or Batman or Superman or any of the X-Men in that same situation, and it doesn't really have the same amount of gravity. But when it's a real person, somebody who could be your sister or your neighbor or your best friend from college, like, it takes on a different kind of life and resonates in a different way. It resonates rather than sort of just flies by as, like, another fight scene, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, one more thing I want to talk with you about, and that is vampires. You know, because for a while I was thinking that vampires had kind of run their course, but you took a different spin on it. I'm not used to vampires as drug dealers. I thought that was a very unique take on this whole business, which I really thought was, I haven't seen that. And, you know, I've watched a lot of Buffy. I've watched a lot of vampire, you know, lore and stuff like that, but I have not seen this kind of a take. So for me, this was kind of an interesting, you know, place I haven't been before. So I like that about the story. I'm going to be curious to see how this progresses from there.
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, I couldn't do, like, a Buffy love letter without tackling vampires in some ways. So, like, that's definitely part of where it came from. The original pitch in my mind was, like, what if Buffy had to fight the Lost Boys? You know, sort of like punk rock gang of vampires. But really where the vampire thing came from. Well, let me take a step back. I wholeheartedly disagree that vampires and all of the traditional universal monsters have or ever will run their course.
Okay.
There's a reason why, you know, Dracula was written in God, the late 1800s, I think. Mm-hmm. And we're still seeing vampire lore in mass media and pop culture to this day. It's certain takes on vampires have certainly run their course. And as a global society have gotten more science and some of the mysticism out of it, it's become less scary. So one of the things I challenged myself to do in each of these issues is sort of find a modern take on what the monster would be. Each issue has a different monster, sort of like a season of Buffy. And then each issue together tells the whole story like a season of Buffy. But there was a built-in metaphor that, like, presented itself early on in that vampires are bloodsuckers. You know, they literally take advantage of other people. And that very much mirrored, like, what Kale is going through, like, in the sort of arc she's on. Like, she is somebody who relies on other people to do everything for her because she doesn't have the structure that we talked about. So early on in the book, you see her calling her mom, hitting her up for cash because she needs food and because, you know, things aren't going great. You find out part of the reason Sid went missing was because Kale was just grinding on him, like relying too much on him. And in that weird way, like, addicts are bloodsuckers in and of themselves too. Not all and not all the time. And it's not something that is necessarily their fault, but it's an honest take based on my experience that it can be very hard for these people to find structure, so it's easy for them to lean on others. Like my cousin Tom, who I mentioned earlier, has been in and out of rehab and jail over the years, and, like, you know, I to as far as I could possibly go would do anything I can to help him stay on the straight and narrow and do what he needs to do. And it always starts with a phone call. Hey, can I get a ride to probation? Mm-hmm. And always happy to do it. And then it's, hey, I got this fine payment due. Can I borrow $100? And you know that it's not actually, you're not lending it, you're giving it. And but it gets bigger and bigger and more often and more often. And because, you know, it's fine line walking that space between being an enabler and letting people take advantage and helping. And I don't know if I mentioned this last time, but one of the books that I read that really, really influenced my storytelling style is the sequel to Ender's Game. It's called Speaker for the Dead. I do not endorse Orson Scott Card in any way, shape, or form, but those two books are not bad. But the basic idea for Speaker of the Dead is that Ender, after the events of Ender's Game, has grown up and has become essentially like a professional eulogist. He goes around giving eulogies for people whenever he's called. But he treats it more like being a private eye. Like, he investigates the person's entire life, like warts and all, and then prepares a eulogy for them of sorts, but presents like an accurate, honest depiction of the person, like all their faults, all their misdeeds, all their good deeds, and just, you know, doesn't pass any kind of judgment, just tells it as it is. Almost like we're led to believe old school journalism was just the facts, you know, and you make of it what you will. And like, that always felt like a really good way to look at things, like, you know, just with an honest view. And when I decided to write a story about drug addicts and recovering addicts, like, I wanted to take an honest view, not anything romanticizing them, making people feel sorry for them, but also nothing damning them either, because these are people who are struggling. Like, I don't want to paint them as villains either. So yeah, Kayla is a piece of shit. And this is a story about her realizing she's a piece of shit, but she's also got potential to be a good person. And that potential is inside of her. Like, you know, she's got to find the strength and the structure to put it out in the world and make herself a better person without, you know, taking advantage of other people. So that's sort of where the vampire metaphor came from. Like, they're bloodsuckers. She's bloodsuckers. Or she's a bloodsucker. And like, that was sort of like the spark that like tied everything together for me and got me writing when I was on that plane I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Now, I got to tell you, towards the end, and I'm not going to spoil it, there's a big surprise. Something's been going on in the book, and you point out that it isn't what we think it is at the very end, in the last sequence of the book. And I was shocked when I read that. I literally had to, wait a minute, I had to go back and read that again. Is that true? Because something that we've been seeing happen is not what we think it is. So I was really, really, I have to say, I love to be surprised. When somebody can surprise me, I love that. And that last sequence shocked me.
Well, that's good. And yeah, that was what I was hoping for, because that's another one of those sort of quiet sequences. Like, the last, there's like two scenes toward the end that are kind of quiet. And that, I think you're talking about that second to last one before the next morning. There's definitely some double entendre like dialogue in there, and I had a lot of fun writing it, but also like, it's like extremely tragic and like surprising even to me. Like, I wrote it and like, I still like look at that scene, I'm like, oh wow, that really happens. So yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that, and you're not the first person, so I think that little bit will land the way I'm hoping it did, or will. So yeah,
I really loved it. I was so surprised. And I, like I said, I love surprises. Your writing does that to me. Every few pages or so, I get a good surprise. And I go, what? I thought it was this way, and then it's not.
Yeah, it's so gratifying to hear people. Like, I think this is maybe the fifth or sixth podcast I've done on the sort of press tour for No Heroin. And, like, everybody, you always wonder if, like, praise is, like, a little embellished, or like, if people are gonna like your thing as much as they like the last thing, or if they'll like it in a different way. And like, it's been gratifying to hear people sort of picking up on the little things and enjoying the trip, because this is so different than grief, and it's so different than Dead End Kids. And like, you know, the majority of people who are gonna come check it out are the people who enjoyed those things. And like, you always wonder if, you know, you can only hit so many home runs before you foul out, right?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I would say that you have developed a method of telling stories that it always surprises me, and I always love that. And I, like I said, when we got to the very last several pages of the book, I was stunned. I just, of course, you know what that means. I got to read the next one. That's the thing. I go, when I get to that, I'm dying to read the next thing. Now, you said this is coming out in summer. Do you have any idea when the first issue is going to hit the stands?
Well, so we're doing this interview a little bit in advance, and that's something, like I mentioned earlier, I like to experiment and sort of like reconsider things. Last year, I think, I have to say, like, for anyone who makes comics who's listening to this or is interested in how comics get made, I think in terms of marketing, podcasts are probably the most fertile soil. It's a big canvas to talk about your book with a built-in audience, people who come for every episode. And it's an opportunity that, you know, an article on the front of Bleeding Cool is very cool, and I've been super blessed to have a few. But that's there for as long as there aren't 10 new stories to bury it, and then it's gone forever. And then even if people do click on it, you can only say so much in like a press release or like a few questions that you have to type out the answers to. So I really enjoy doing podcasts. I started doing this press tour a couple months early, just because I figured if I could do more, scale up the operation, I'm going to try and do 50 or so before the book hits. So it's January now. The first issue is going to come out in June. And it'll be 3 issues. They'll be a little oversized, a little bit bigger than Dead End Kids was. I don't like the idea of doing longer miniseries just because it's hell to promote 5 and 6 issues. Like the drop off rate is incredibly high. Like if your book gets hot, like it's really hard to sustain momentum that long. David Boer and Drew Zucker, who did Canto this year, they had a 6-issue mini, and like watching them hustle for like the extra 3 months that I didn't have to was, I felt their pain. So anyway, it's January now. The book will come out in June, July, and August of this year, as long as there are no, you know, delays on Diamond side. We are almost done with issue 2, and issue 3 is about to start. So we're pretty well ahead of schedule, unless I get hit by a car or something. The book will come out on time. But because we're doing this so early, the Diamond order code is not available. That's actually one of the flaws in the Diamond system, is you don't, as the creator, know your order code until the beginning of 2 months before the book comes out, or 3 months before the book comes out. But there's only a 2-month window to order books, which is why I wanted to try and, you know, get the word out a little earlier this time. But honestly, the order code's not important. If you know the name of the book, No Heroine, if you know my name, Frank Ogle, if you know Source Point Press, the publisher, any of those three things is enough information to help your local comic shop guy or gal track down the book for you when it is up for pre-order, which will be in April and May.
Now, I have to say, too, that the show, shop that I go to, they let you hand write stuff that may not be in the an order form yet. Yeah. So there's certain books I want to get. I write them down in there. And so they look down there, and when it finally hits the previews, they can order it for me. So I don't know if every shop does that, but mine does, and I really appreciate that because I don't have to try to keep it in my memory. And I can know that they'll see it and they'll go for it when it comes out. So I hope the shops will do that, because, you know, this is the time to get the word in and get let the shops know that you want it.
Yeah. And honestly, like, not to be like too self-promotional, because I don't like when people are like that. But if anyone who's listening feels so inclined to follow me on Twitter or Instagram or shoot me a Facebook friend request or sign up for the newsletter I mentioned, the info is sort of on repeat in those things from time to time. And like, you know, I can keep it in your periphery as I keep talking about it, if you're at all interested. And, you know, Bleeding Cool and other sites will probably cover it when we announce it, like the official dates and everything in March. I know for a fact that we're going to do sort of an early preview of issue 1 variant cover for Emerald City Comic Con. Chris and I will both be there. We'll have a limited quantity of those with a cover that Chris did. So like we're going to keep the hype train going beyond just this interview and other interviews. And there's lots of ways we're going to talk about this book and try and keep it on the periphery of people's minds until we can actually get pre-orders started.
Any chance this could be on Free Comic Book Day?
Nah. Okay. Free Comic Book Day is an incredibly hard thing to A, get approved for, and B, like, pull off well. Sourcepoint did a Free Comic Book Day book last year, and it did okay. Like, it was a good book. It you know, I think we did maybe 70,000 copies of it for Free Comic Book Day. But, like, there's just so much noise on Free Comic Book Day. I think there were, like, 180 different titles available, and most shops got at least 80 of them or something crazy like that. Mm-hmm. I might be making those numbers up. They may not be that high. But Free Comic Book Day is tough. And you have to, I don't know the exact dates, but I know that it's about a year in advance that everything's like sort of applied for and approved. So like by the time we got this book ready, it was that window was long closed.
Well, it tends to be family oriented stuff too.
Yeah. Every comic book day. Same thing with Halloween Comic Fest. That's even more kid focused. There is local comic shop day, and it's something that I have an idea for maybe next year if we can make it work. But it's you never really know, and you don't want to sort of make too many plans and have to like I have a lot of projects going on, so like add another thing to the to-do list. you never know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm sure that the guys in charge of Source Point Press do a good job of getting the word out. Their brains are all working on it right now, I bet you.
Yeah, and honestly, if I could take a moment, just like, if No Heroine doesn't sound like the book for you, or Dead End Kids, or Grief didn't, like, there are so many incredible titles coming out of Source Point Press from, God, I think there are well over 100 people involved with this publisher at this point, like at different levels and mostly creators. Like it's such a weird, amazing, it's like a family more so than a publisher. And like, it's an incredible support network. So if you like horror, you like sci-fi, you like Westerns, you like weird shit, you like Firefly, like no matter what your flavor of comic is, there's some indie version of it at Source Point Press. So like I said, if No Heroine's not the book for you, go check out Bob Sally's Ogre or Salvagers or Casey Pierce's Nora or David Hayes's The Rot. Like there's just so much good stuff coming out of there that like honestly, like I'm always sharpening my own toolkit and trying to improve myself so I can keep up with these people.
Well, that's where I met you, was at Source Point Press booth at Baltimore Comic Con last year.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things that Source Point is doing right that I think that other publishers, at least indie publishers, should take note of. Source Point puts up its creators at conventions. So one of the benefits I have is that they do somewhere between 60 and 70 shows a year. And I can reach out to Travis McIntyre, who runs Source Point Press, and say, hey, Travis, I'm super interested in these cons. So I see we've got a table on the schedule. You got room for me? You need extra bodies? And they'll say yes most of the time. I don't think he's actually ever told me no. And then all I have to do is get myself there. They generally take care of the hotel rooms unless it's like a really expensive show like New York or San Diego. And then we work the booth and sell their product so that they can have a successful booth. I have time on the floor to meet people like you and people who enjoy Dead End Kids and Grief. And what it does is it gives me time with the other creators and the other creators' time with each other to get to know each other. And like that's where that sort of familial feeling comes from. We are friends. Like we hang out a bunch of weekends a year and work long days together and get delirious from 10-hour shifts. But it's all a shared bonding experience, sort of like hazing.
Well, it's connections. I mean, you're making contacts with other people that are probably in the same place that you might be, and that there might be some things you can share. If somebody has success in one thing, and you're looking for some answers in that area, and they might be able to tell you some of those.
Exactly. It comes with a built-in network of probably 150 people, if you include people who aren't creators, who are friends or really good acquaintances or family members who pitch in, and like. I mean, it's just an incredible operation. And the fact that, like, you know, like I said, they will open up some floor space for you to be at a con and you don't have to pay for your own table if you work for them. Like, everybody wins. I get to be at 9 conventions in the first 6 months of this year, and I'm paying for a table. I'm paying for flights. I was going to be paying for those flights anyway. So, like, it's honestly a huge win for the creators. And the company does really well, too. Like, you know, most conventions are profitable for them.
Very good. Well, I see Source Point Press wherever I go. So whatever cons I'm at, I see them there. So they do some good stuff.
That's the other one. Denver. The con was the 9th one.
All right.
That's in the first week of July, I think. That's the last
one. Okay. All right. What about Baltimore? Going back
there? Baltimore is a little bit later in the year. So yeah. The booth is not manned yet by anybody. So I would like to. I've done it the last 2 years. It's a good show. I'm going to be pushing as hard or harder this year for Dead End Kids to get a Ringo nomination. So if it gets a Ringo nomination, the Ringo Awards are at Baltimore. So that would be a good reason for me to be there. I would love to. One part of it is depending on the when the date is. It's always very close to New York Comic Con, and I always do New York Comic Con, whether it does a fan or a creator. So depending on like my days off situation toward the end of the year and whether I'm needed there or if it's feasible, like there, that one is up in the air, but I can commit to that I would like to.
Okay, because I like New York Comic Con too. That's my favorite. I went to Dragon Con for the first time last year, and I really enjoyed it. I
was that's just the Atlanta one?
Atlanta, Dragon Con. That was such a good con. My gosh, that was just amazing.
It's on my radar. I've got that and Atlanta Comic Con earmarked as potentials for this year because one of the things I want to do this year is go some places I've never been before. That's why Dallas is on the schedule. That's why Orlando is on the schedule. I'm trying to do 20 conventions in 2020 because I like number play. So I'm up to 9. We'll see how the next 11 pan out. Cool.
Well, you're talking like you're already good and busy. Are these things going to keep you busy? Are there stuff you're working on that you can't talk about quite yet? Is there something you can talk about, or should we wait until we get a chance to talk again sometime?
Dead End Kids Trade is in previews right now, so that'll come out in March, and the pre-order window is right now. Honestly, I don't not talk about things. one of the things I don't understand about comics, and this there could be reasons that I don't know, but like we don't really talk about projects until they're announced, and they're generally announced right before they go into previews, and then essentially like that's a 2-month window for people to like A, become aware, and then B, become interested in your product, and then maybe pre-order it. Like I generally speak very freely about my stuff unless there's a reason not to talk about it. So like I said, Dead End Kids 2 is being written right now. I've got some idea. I've basically got like a 3-year roadmap. I have what I call like my 3-year plan. Essentially what it is it's a plan of all the things that I can do, like realistically, to set myself up to be a full-time freelancer by 3 years from this, you know, the beginning of this year. So January 2023. So I've got a schedule of the books that I'm going to write. I've got sort of like goals for you know, marketing, like a lot of like really uninteresting stuff too. But another big part of it is making sure I have at least 1 year's worth of salary in my savings account, which is the biggest hurdle, honestly. But I think a lot of creatives go freelance before they're ready. And like, unfortunately, I have the benefit of learning from my friends' mistakes. And like, I don't want to be in a position where I A, don't have money, and B, don't have money coming in, and also don't have health insurance. And like, so I'm just trying to over prepare in a lot of ways, and also give myself time to like make the connections. And like, comics is not a sprint, it's a marathon. I know that's a cliche, but like, by the time 2023 rolls around, I'll have been doing this for 7 years.
Wow.
Like, if you can, I wrote the first story in Grief in 2016, so I consider like that the official start of my comics career. Wow. So like, yeah, it's not an easy, quick road. So like, mm-hmm. 7 years is even kind of quick, honestly. Like, and I don't know if I'll land where I'm thinking I will, but I'm gonna do my damnedest to try and be prepared if it is reality.
Again, overnight success that took 6 years to get there.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the common sort of misconceptions about comics is like that people break in overnight. Like, I guess it was 3 years ago now. Like, Donny Cates had God Country come out, and people were like, oh my God, this Donny Cates guy is great. Donny is amazing. He's an incredible writer. But he didn't come out of nowhere, and that wasn't his first comic. I mean, nobody remembers Ghost Fleet, and nobody remembers Buzzkills because they weren't reading those books until God Country sort of blew him up. But they were really good books too. They just didn't do for his career what God Country did, and less people know about them. Like, I suspect that if I ever make it, I'll have a breakout book, whether it's Dead End Kids 2, Dead End Kids 3, No Heroin, or whatever. And then Grief and Dead End Kids 1 or anything that came before it people might not realize that I wrote those things. And if I'm ever writing like Daredevil or something, they'll be like, oh, this guy kind of came out of nowhere. Like Brian Bendis did. He hustled for about 10 years. He was at every single convention he could get to, like living like a very unglorious life, you know, just sort of scraping by. And then he got Ultimate Spider-Man and Daredevil very close together. And people were like, oh yeah, he just walked in the comics. Fuck that. He took a long, steep walk up the comics.
Yeah.
That's true for like 99.9% of creators. Yeah. who's the bad robot guy? J. Abrams. His son is like the one exception to the rule. You know, he just got the right Spider-Man. But yeah, so I have a plan. It's realistic. It's very measured and very. It's got like some very, very realistic expectations about what's achievable. Like the truth of the matter with freelance is like there's nothing you personally can do about it to make it happen. It's not a decision you can make for yourself. And it's not something that you can sort of like you can possibly grease the wheels a little bit like by like part of the reason I wrote No Heroine is because I would love to write some Buffy the Vampire Slayer one day. Boom has it now. The books they're doing over there are incredible, and I'd love to maybe one day leave my mark on it. And having a young woman who fights monsters type book is a good calling card for being able to be considered for a gig like that. So, you know, there are certain things you can do to help your situation, but at the end of the day, it's out of your hands completely. Even the editor doesn't necessarily make the decision, especially on like a licensed property, right? There are licensors and publishers and legal departments and a whole list of people who have to like approve you for those jobs. So it's just, you know, it's like the old cliche about luck. Luck is being prepared for opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to be as prepared as I can if the opportunity should arise. If I can do things to sort of coax the opportunity, that's great, but I'm not going to put all my money on that.
Well, you're doing a smart thing. You're presenting the good stuff so that people can start to become aware of you. And I think that's a great thing. And that's how Matthew Rosenberg ended up on all the Marvel books that he does these days. He did that Four Kids Walk Into a Bank.
Yeah.
And boom, next thing you know, Marvel's after him. And I was like, really?
Yeah. Matt's actually one of the people I model my career on. Because, yeah, Matt did Four Kids Walk Into a Bank, and it blew up, and it really helped his career. But he also wrote before that We Can Never Go Home. Mm-hmm. He wrote a licensed property for a rap group and a bunch of the first book Black Mask ever put out, the one for Occupy Wall Street, I think it was Occupy. He had a story in there, and that, I think that was like 2010, maybe 2011. But like Matt... You know, he worked his way into it, just like Bendis and just like I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Matt's actually, I wouldn't consider, say, Matt's a friend of mine, but he's an acquaintance. And he actually, when Dead End Kids was coming out in August of this year, I got talking to him in a bar at Boston Comic Con, Fan Expo Boston. And we were just chatting, and I was honestly like picking his brain for advice because, like I said, I model a lot of what I do based on things that I know he did, and he's not the only person I look to, but he's somebody who I think had the right idea of how to go about this. So I was picking his brain, and I was sort of asking him about, like, you know, Marvel and what that experience was like. And it turned out that like 5 feet away from us was Ricky Purdon, who is the talent coordinator / scout for Marvel Comics. And Matt was like, "Hey, listen, man, you got a book that's kind of hot right now. Like, if you think you've got the chops, you know, reach out. Like, what do you have to lose?" So I thought about it, and a couple days later, I did reach out to Ricky on Twitter, and he got back to me like really quick. Asked me if I could send some samples. We did this whole like private invite FTP transfer, like with like an expiration date on it, like for me to send samples. Like, it was very, very like confidential, wild experience. Nothing's come of it, and I can say that in all honesty. And I honestly didn't expect anything necessarily come from it. But you know, it's like I really appreciated what Matt did. Like he inspired me to take a shot. Like, I mean, and at the very least, I'm on Ricky's radar now. And I wouldn't have been if I didn't talk to Matt.
That's right. You have to be there when they are looking for somebody.
Exactly.
That's what you have to do. So I still think X-Men's in your future someday. I think we're going to see your name on an X-Men book.
You know, I really do. I'm not a huge X-Men fan. Like, I've been reading X-Men since about Joss Whedon's run, mostly because Joss was on it. And then I read back to Grant Morrison's stuff before that. And up until about a year ago, I would have taken the challenge of writing an X book just because the line was struggling and, like, I think there was some room for, like, to try some stuff, but the Dawn of X stuff and the House of X and Powers of 10 stuff is just so good that I wouldn't even, if they offered, I'd say, no, thanks. I can't. Like, I'm too intimidated. So I want to work on a B-list character, a C-list character, and like figure out what corporate comics is like so I can figure out how to do it right before I tackle even gold balls.
Well, I didn't say you'd start on X-Men. I said you'd get there someday. So,
well, I've got a wish list. I've got a really cool Dark Avengers pitch. I've got a pretty good idea for a Hawkeye series. I'd love to write some Iron Fist. I'd love to write one issue of Black Panther. I don't think that me being a white man, like, I wouldn't want to do anything extended on Black Panther. I think that there are other voices that are more authentic that should be tackling it before I do. But I would love to write a one-shot or a short story or a story with Black Panther. I appreciate the character. It's one of my favorite. He's one of my favorites. So yeah, I mean, I've got a wish list of Marvel characters. I've got a few DC characters I'd love to tackle. There's definitely a lot of properties I'd love to tackle. Power Rangers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I've been getting into the Transformers stuff that IDW is doing. I'd love to take a crack at some of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm open. Like, I would, honestly, oh God, I always forget his name. Who is the guy who writes Isola?
Writes what?
Isola, Isola.
Oh, you mean
Brandon Fletcher?
It's one of my favorite books. It's a Brandon name. It's
Brandon Fletcher, I think.
Fletcher, that's it. Yeah, that's the guy.
I saw him talk at a con way back, maybe when I first started writing comics in 2016, and he was talking about how Marvel had finally called him up to do something for them, and it was a short story for like a Hulk anthology book or something, and they were like, we got a Korg story. Do you want to write Korg? And he's like, oh yeah, I love Korg. I'd love to write a Korg story. And then he gets off the phone with him. He's like, who the hell is Korg? like that always stuck with me. I was like, you know, any publisher could throw any character my way and I would try.
Yeah, I think he's doing Macross now for is it Macross or one of those big machine franchises that he was a fan of when he was growing up.
Yeah, he's been doing a bunch of stuff. He was doing he had Motocross for a while, and I think that's still going in the background. Isola's going. I mean, he's doing some pretty incredible stuff, and he's worked with some fantastic artists. Like, I mean, mind-blowing artists. I'm very jealous of him. Not that I don't love my collaborators, who it's occurring to me now I haven't mentioned, so if I could just take a moment to talk to them. So the No Heroine team is five people. It's myself on writing, the pain and poetry. On art, we've got Chris Madd, who did the covers for Dead End Kids and is doing the interior art for all of this book. On colors, we have Chris's daughter, Shauna Madd, who is, it's just incredible that they're a tag team like that. I'm still blown away. And they're both incredibly talented. On letters, I've got my old buddy, Sean Reinhardt, who did all of Grief, who did Dead End Kids, who's lettered pretty much everything I've ever written. Sean's a genius, and I will work with him until I can't afford him someday when he's super good, famous. And on covers, we've got Ahmed Raffit, who did a series of variant covers for Dead End Kids, some convention exclusives, sort of what we called the noir covers. They're sort of crime-themed adolescent covers, and the interiors of the books were all black and white, so they're sort of our noir ones. And I love working with Ahmed. We're doing a one-shot together that doesn't have a name officially yet, but it's called The Farm, and it's kind of like a late golden age Hollywood slasher movie. And he's just a dream to work with, and he's really collaborative in the way that Chris is and everyone else I've ever gotten to work with. So he's doing all the covers. The first two I've posted online at this point, and we've got like a really sort of distinct style that's kind of an homage to the David Aja Hawkeye series of covers, but sort of with our own twist on it. And like, just like, this is really, it's just a dream team. Like, the whole book feels like a package. And like the version that you got to read was sort of like a choppy copy, isn't like the official final copy, but it's a fair approximation of what the end result's going to look like. And yeah, I'm sure you can attest to like that there's a definitive feel that this book has, an aesthetic that goes with. Yep,
absolutely. It really has this really strong sense of it, knows where it's going. It really is great. I really love the storytelling in it. It's just a great thing. It just, I expect big things out of this book. I really do. I think it's going to be this could be the one. Get your name out there.
Fingers crossed. Like, and then if it's not the next one, and if it's not that one, then I don't do this to be famous or to make money. And honestly, I wouldn't make money if I wanted to. Like, making comics is not lucrative. But I've just got a storytelling bug inside of me. These demons I got to let out, and I enjoy doing this. You know, and I'm lucky enough to have a wife who supports me chasing my dream, like not financially supports me, but yeah, lets me squirrel myself away into an office for a weekend and then go away 20 weekends a year for conventions, and is happy to have me out of the house so she can hang out with the cat and the dog and watch Netflix and drink wine, like have her time. So yeah, it's I hope people will check this book out, and I hope they'll dig it in the same way and in new ways that they did Dead End Kids in Grief. Like they're all definitely spiritually connected in that, like, they're the kind of stories that I want to tell. Like, I am very interested in telling stories that are about something in a, like, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's like nothing I've read before, and I've read a lot of Buffy, and I've watched a lot of Buffy on TV, but there are twists and turns to this that just aren't Buffy. And that's what makes this book stand out to me. I really enjoyed the stuff. Like I said, I can't wait to see number two. Number two can't get here fast enough for me, because now I want to know what's going to happen next. So, really good stuff. So, Frank, I got to tell you, I think that ladder's going up and up and up every time you do something. I think you get a little more attention, if not a whole lot at one time. And I think we're going to see Frank Ogle's name on a lot of tremendous books as the years come. So I think it'll be a big star when things come along.
I appreciate that.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast, so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's a wrap for this episode. And in coming weeks, I'll have some great interviews, so be sure to be here. But until then, keep reading your comics.